Chapter 17.
We've had our first taste of real winter weather here, and I don't mean just the water freezing in our pails. We're used to that by now. We had our first snow this week, and it took us all by surprise. The inhabitants say they've never known it to start so early, and they hadn't thought they'd see us again until spring. But nothing stops these women from their appointed rounds. Nell Baldwin staggered off to Esmerie Hallon and came back just before supper looking like a walking icicle. Our assistant director had to take our one working truck and go off after the Van Alden girl, who had, it appeared, spent all day in a miserable hut to make a dying woman as comfortable as possible. Pneumonia, in case you were wondering. We have a great deal of pneumonia here. As for yours truly, this morning, Dr. Prine and I arose at 5:30 and started for Ambleu with the horse and cart. I use the term horse broadly, lent us by the sous-préfet. We got a little more than halfway and found the snow in such drifts that we had to abandon the cart entirely and walk the beast the rest of the way to Ambleu. I think it expected us to carry it, but we were already carrying half a medicine chest on our backs and had to decline. If the snow keeps up, we are going to be in a very bad way indeed. Our villages cover such a large territory. Dr. Eva Stringfellow, class of 1896, to her husband, Dr. Lawrence Stringfellow. December 1917. Grecourt, France. Emmy. Sick with relief at finding her, Kate grabbed Emmy before she could go herring off for a shovel. We can't just bury this, whoever it is. She'll need the last rites. We'll tell the commandant. He'll send a priest when the snow lets up, she added with a grimace at the road, which wasn't much of a road at the moment. Emmy looked down at Kate with stricken eyes, making it impossible to be upset with her. But we can't just leave her. Her cat will eat her. Kate wasn't quite sure cats ate people like that, but she knew that once Emmy got an idea in her head, there was no budging it. Which one is the mayor? She asked resignedly. The mayor, unfortunately, was no more excited than Kate by the idea of hiking up the snow-covered hill to fetch a body. Also, Kate was interfering with her children's bedtime and letting the cold air in. 5 minutes later, Kate returned to Emmy with the best compromise she could broker. She says the Germans used the old bathhouse as a morgue. If we get Madame Lepanasse down, we can put her there. And that was how Kate found herself, in the dark, the ruins of a medieval castle looming over her, carrying a body down a hill, with Madame Lepanasse's cat hissing and spitting irritably from the depths of Emmy's haversack. She was also liberally coated with snow from having fallen while carrying said corpse.
I feel like Victor Frankenstein, commented Emmy, her teeth chattering uncontrollably.
Remind me not to consider a career in body snatching, panted Kate as Emmy edged backward ahead of her, holding the corpse's feet while Kate grasped the body awkwardly beneath the arms, the head bumping disconcertingly against her chest.
Do you think we've become hard? Emmy asked anxiously.
They were carrying a woman's body down a snow-covered slope in pitch darkness so her cat wouldn't eat her. The idea of Emmy becoming hard would have made Kate laugh if she'd had the energy to laugh.
No, can we keep moving, please? I can't feel my feet.
Finally, Madame Lepanasse was safely stowed in the makeshift morgue and her cat with the mayor, whose toddler had been delighted and immediately tried to pull its tail. Emmy looked anxiously over her shoulder as she climbed into the jitney.
Do you think we should try to go straight to Amiens to get them to send a priest?
Wrap yourself up in that lap rug, ordered Kate as she vigorously turned the crank, her breath steaming in the cold air.
And no one will come tonight. We'd best get back to Grecourt and send word in the morning, if the roads are clear enough.
They weren't clear now.
The lamps of the jitney glinted off an entirely unrecognizable landscape, softened by snow, the barbed wire and broken buildings all turned into something pure and lovely.
It looks like gingerbread, said Emmy dreamily.
In the light of the car lamps, her lips were a distinct blue. Kate could practically see the veins through her skin.
A gingerbread world, all frosted with sugar.
When's the last time you ate? Kate asked.
Breakfast?
Emmy stirred a little, pulling herself upright.
I guess that would explain why I've been feeling so lightheaded.
Yes, said Kate resignedly. Yes, it would. This was the problem of trying to be angry with Emmy. One just couldn't, not for extended periods of time. Emmy was so busy giving and giving and giving that she never thought to care for herself, so that inevitably someone, that someone being Kate, had to step in and do it for her, and you just couldn't stay angry at someone who didn't even remember to eat. Emmy fingered her haversack.
I've some DeWitts in my satchel. I brought them from Madame Lepanasse.
And that was just like Emmy, too. She'd set the biscuits on the woman's grave as funeral offerings rather than eat them herself. As gently as she could, Kate said, I'm sure she wouldn't begrudge them to you.
No, she wouldn't. She liked feeding people. She'd been a cook, you know, up at the castle, and then, during the war, she helped feed the village.
Emmy clutched her haversack with both hands.
She wasn't even that old, about the same age as my mother. In her 50s, maybe. I keep thinking, if only I had come sooner.
Kate felt a brief stab of guilt. She'd made out the Rota for truck use as fairly as she could, and Corcel was so far, on the outer edges of their rounds. It used up so much essence, and essence was in such short supply. You weren't to know.
But I should have known. If I had been doing my job.
Emmy squirmed on the bench seat.
She had no one, Kate. Just us.
More sharply than she intended, Kate said, There are 2,000 people here who need us. Many of them have no one. You can't let yourself get too attached.
Too attached?
Emmy stared at her in horror.
They're people, Kate.
So are we. Kate's shoulders tensed as the jitney wobbled in the deep tracks left by some larger, heavier vehicle. She had never been so aware of her own frailty, her own limitations, just flesh and blood and force of will. We're only people, Emmy. We can't be in 50 places at once.
If we changed the schedule,
Emmy began.
How?
They'd come to a crossroads. Kate swung the truck east toward Greycourt.
There are only 15 of us, 13 now with Maud and Liza in Paris. I wish we could do more. I wish we had trucks that worked, Emmy, and people to drive them, but there's only so much we can do with what we have. What if I learned how to drive? If we had another driver?
The thought of Emmy at the wheel was so horrifying that Kate turned her head for a moment to look at Emmy. A mistake. Ahead of them on the road, a dark shape loomed up, large as a woolly mammoth. Breathing in sharply, thinking all the words her mother had told her never to say, Kate braked hard, feeling a sickening lurch as the truck swayed and spun. For a moment, she thought she could feel Nick Peniston's hands on her shoulders, hear his confident voice saying, "If you lose control of the machine, drive into the spin." Blindly, Kate turned the wheel in the direction of the skid, feeling the truck finally, mercifully stop, just short of a snow-covered hedge. She sat there, breathing hard, a cold sweat prickling beneath the linen and wool of her uniform.
Well,
said Emmy weakly, picking herself gingerly up from the floor of the truck. She rolled one shoulder, wincing.
If that's how you feel about my driving.
Kate pointed a shaking finger.
That's how I feel about their driving.
Blocking the road was an overturned army camion. A slow anger churned in her stomach.
The idiots! They could have at least pushed it to the side of the road. If we'd hit that... But we didn't.
Emmy bumped her shoulder against Kate's in a quick gesture of affection, and Kate felt her chest tighten because it was so like Emmy. Always these fleeting touches, as if she were afraid she'd be pushed away.
Thank goodness you're such a smashing driver.
I'm trying not to smash, thank you very much. Kate drew in a deep, cleansing breath, feeling the cold scouring the back of her throat. She'd have had no idea what to do but for Nick. Had Nick taught her that? She didn't remember it. Her memory was of endless sunshine along Bellevue Avenue, but he must have. Otherwise, how would she have known? Nick Peniston showed me what to do.
Well, thank goodness for Nick then, said Emmy with feeling, and Kate tried not to glance around her shoulder for the shade of a man in goggles and scarf. The dark and cold were making her fanciful.
How can we get around them?
We can't. Forcing herself to focus, Kate took a deep breath, flexed her shoulders, and readjusted her grip on the wheel. I'm going to back up until we can turn. We'll have to find another way. Get that map out, will you? Very, very carefully, they backed up, retracing their own tire tracks. But the snow had knocked down rotten signposts, and those that were still standing were so blurred they were hardly legible. They backed up and turned again, burning match after match from Emmy's haversack, trying to read the tiny print on the map.
Cookie?
Offered Emmy as they came to yet another illegible signpost. Kate shook her head. We'd best ration them. We might need them later. If the cold didn't kill them first. I haven't the faintest idea where we are. Emmy peered at the sky, which still had that overcast aura, as though it were contemplating snowing again.
Could we navigate by the stars?
Like Vasco da Gama? Kate didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Emmy contemplated.
I think he used an astrolabe.
Yes, well, we don't have one of those either, said Kate. They had two choices, both unpalatable. They could go on and risk going the wrong way, getting farther and farther from Greycore, possibly even blundering into hostilities, or they could stop for the night. I'd say we should stop for the night and reconnoiter in the morning, but if we do, we might freeze.
I'm in favor of not freezing, said Emmy.
With the echo of her old optimism, she added,
Surely we'll find someone sooner or later.
So they went on roads eerie in their emptiness. Usually the night was the safest time for troops to travel. The roads were generally thick with army camions, with French or English troops on the move, supply trucks, ambulance drivers going back and forth from the front, the air lit by the flashing lights of airplanes overhead. But tonight, with the storm, the roads were abandoned, unrecognizable. Even the planes weren't flying. Kate began to go from annoyed to afraid, genuinely afraid, afraid that their petrol would run out, afraid that they wouldn't find shelter before the cold claimed them. She drove on, grimly, wondering how long it would be before they would have to stop and rinse their feet in snow water to ward off frostbite. Her toes were dangerously numb. Emmy was buried so deep in her muffler that Kate could hardly see her. In a very small voice, she said,
Thank you for coming to get me.
I was hardly going to leave you roaming a war zone. It sounded so grudging put that way. Kate tried again.
You know I wouldn't leave you there. You've been so upset.
Emmy's voice changed. She jerked upright.
Kate! Kate, over there! To the left! I mean the right! Do you see the light? Is that?
It's a house. Kate felt lightheaded with relief. A house, and an army camion in front of it. No, two camions. Maybe they can tell us where we are. Emmy was already straightening up, adjusting her coat, fussing with her mittens.
I was afraid we were going to run out of essence, she admitted, and freeze.
I'm sure it wouldn't come to that, said Kate, even though she had been thinking the exact same thing. She spotted a man detaching himself from the side of one of the camions. A cigarette tip glowing red in the darkness.
Look, there's a soldier guarding the camions. We can ask him where we are.
The soldier pitched his cigarette to the ground, grinding out the stub.
Qui va là?
Les dames américaines,
said Emmy eagerly, half falling out of the truck.
Sorry, we're a bit frozen. We've lost our way. We're trying to get back to Grey Corps, but we haven't the faintest idea where we are.
The soldier looked at the jitney, and then back at them.
All by yourselves?
There was something about the way he said it that Kate didn't quite like. If you could just show us on the map, she said coolly, we'll be on our way. He could do better than that, the soldier said, suddenly very helpful. He could escort them as far as Om if they were willing to wait an hour. He and his comrades in arms were just having a bit of supper. Would les dames américaines, he essayed an exaggerated bow, care to share their repast?
Oh, yes, please, exclaimed Emmy, before Kate could decline on their behalf. How kind of you. Isn't it terribly kind?
Yes, said Kate, wondering if the cold had just addled her brain. Here they were, looking for shelter, and they'd found it. But there was something making her uneasy. I'm not sure, though. Emmy jostled her with her elbow.
Food and heat. My fingers are icicles. Either that, or my icicles are fingers, I can't tell which.
Welcome,
said the soldier, throwing open the door and speaking in rapid French to the people inside. Kate caught the words women and alone.
Oh, lovely,
said Emmy, and plunged inside, Kate following more slowly. After the outdoors, the room was smotheringly hot, the air shimmering with steam coming off an iron range, a pot bubbling on the top. Some 7 or 8 French poilus were sitting around a table in their shirt sleeves and braces, being served bowls of soup and thick slices of black bread by a woman who seemed to have forgotten to do up all the ties of her blouse. Another woman sat on the lap of a soldier, removing herself, none too speedily, as they came inside. Behind them, the door slammed shut. Kate turned, frowning, and the guard made little swooshing gestures, urging them forward. He was grinning in a way she didn't at all like, showing teeth stained by cigarettes.
Goodness, it's lovely and warm in here, exclaimed Emmy, happily oblivious, as the woman at the stove surreptitiously did up a button. I can't tell you how grateful we are to have found you.
7 men stared at her. One of them, with black hair slicked back and his sleeves rolled to the elbows, pushed back his chair and stood.
But who are you?
He looked to the guard.
Pierre?
Pierre shrugged.
They just drove up in a truck.
One of the men gave a guttural chuckle.
One doesn't look at the bridle of a gift horse. No, just the legs,
retorted another, and they stared at Kate and Emmy in a way that made Kate put her hands on her collar, even though it was already buttoned as high as it would go. Emmy, whose French wasn't nearly as colloquial, smiled uncertainly at them, aware that there was a joke, but not sure what it was. Kate didn't at all like the way the men were smiling.
We, she said crisply,
are with the American Red Cross.
These men might not have heard of the Smith unit, but everyone knew the Red Cross, and Americans.
Red Cross, eh?
The men all exchanged glances. The leader, the one with the black hair, smiled back at them, showing too many teeth.
We love the Red Cross.
We do what we can, said Emmy, pleased. We're so happy to be here to help.
Oh, I have some ideas for how you can help,
called out one of the men.
Really? We're always looking for ways to improve our services, said Emmy gamely,
and looked confused when that raised a great laugh. Kate edged closer to her.
Emmy, I don't think...
But Emmy was resolved to be pleasant.
We can't tell you how much we appreciate your hospitality.
Kate could see her determinedly ignoring their discarded jackets and the fact that they made no effort to put them back on.
What regiment are you with?
There was a sudden, charged silence. The woman at the stove concentrated hard on her soup pot.
Oh, you wouldn't have heard,
said the black-haired man smoothly.
I told them, said the guard standing behind Kate. that we can take them as far as after we have our supper. Ah, yes, after supper.
The black-haired man banged the table.
Two more bowls of soup. Come, sit, eat.
No, thank you, said Kate, grabbing Emmy's sleeve to keep her from going to the table. There was something about the way the man had said after supper that raised her hackles. She thought, without being sure why, of Julia and the man who just wanted to share his notes, until he didn't. We just need someone to show us where we are on the map, and then we'll be on our way.
But Kate, there's soup.
Emmy had eyes only for the tureen.
Besides, it would be so rude to say no now that they've invited us, and I've only just started to feel my toes. It's already so late. Surely another hour won't make any difference.
The serving woman slammed two bowls down on the table, slopping soup over the sides. Kate didn't like the way the men were looking at them. She didn't like the way the guard was standing between them and the door.
I don't think we should stay, Emmy.
Why are you standing there?
The black-haired man came around the table. Sizing them up, he slung an arm companionably around Emmy's shoulders.
Come, sit. Take off your coat.
Thank you,
Emmy said breathlessly as the man's hands went to the buttons of her coat.
That's very kind of you.
Oh, we are all very kind,
said the man, showing too many teeth as he propelled Emmy toward the table. Emmy grimaced at Kate over her shoulder, more bemused than alarmed. Kate felt frozen, terrified, and helpless. Pausing, one hand on Emmy's shoulder, the black-haired man said quietly to the serving woman,
"The room upstairs, it is free, yes?"
Kate's paralysis broke. She grabbed Emmy's hand, pulling hard. "Emmy, we're going now." The man grabbed Emmy's shoulder, equally hard.
"Oh, no,"
he said, and he wasn't smiling anymore.
"I think she stays."
Kate didn't waste any more time. She hit him right in the nose with the full force of her 5'1" and 102 pounds. She did it the way her stepfather had taught her, striking up with the flat of her palm. Her hand hit his nose with a sickening crunch, sending him reeling backward into the table, men yelping, chairs toppling, soup and bread crashing down. Blood spurted through the man's fingers as he sprawled on the table. He stared at it with disbelief, and then he lifted his head, and Kate saw murder in his eyes. Quick! Grabbing Emmy by the hand, Kate ran for the kitchen door, not looking back, ignoring the angry cries behind them, her fingers fumbling on the door handle, knowing every second counted, every second gave them a chance. Kate was never quite sure how after, but somehow she got Emmy through that door and into the jitney, turning and turning the crank with all her might, praying it wouldn't break down, praying the men wouldn't catch them before they could start, knowing that she'd be no use against all of them. Any one of them could break her arm with one hand tied behind his back. She wished she had a gun like Maud, a knife like Julia, anything.
Go, go, go,
Kate muttered to the jitney and nearly sobbed with relief when the engine caught. Every instinct screamed speed, but she forced herself to go carefully. If the truck broke down, they'd have no escape and the retaliation would be dreadful. Light arced across the snow as the kitchen door swung open. The motor hiccuped, and Kate nearly cried, but then it caught again, the truck jerking backward out of the clearing as the man in the doorway shouted curses, his shirt stained with blood and soup. Kate swung the truck. The road was dreadful, rutted and icy, but she clung grimly to the wheel and kept going, away, away, just away. She had no idea where they were. The only important thing was to put as much distance as possible between them and those men.
But what?
Emmy was twisting back, staring over her shoulder.
You hit him!
Not nearly hard enough. The full realization of what had almost happened swept over her. A room upstairs. Be kind. Alone. Emmy's voice seemed to come from very far away.
Do you think we ought to pay for the damage?
The truck bounced over a pothole. Kate was shaking so hard she could barely hold the wheel.
The what?
Emmy was twisting and twisting her fingers. She was missing her gloves, Kate noticed, probably dropped in their flight.
The damage to that inn.
Pay for the damage?
Kate knew she sounded hysterical. She couldn't help it.
Well, yes, said Emmy, sounding mildly bewildered,
and Kate nearly ran the truck into a ditch.
We did make rather a mess.
Through determined effort, Kate wrenched the car back onto the road, managing not to kill either of them.
You do realize what they meant to do, don't you?
Give us soup and take us to Om?
Said Emmy wistfully.
Do you really believe that?
Kate wasn't sure whether Emmy was being willfully obtuse or whether she was really that naive. Or maybe it was just that Kate had gone mad. But she didn't think so. She remembered the way that man had looked. She remembered Julia.
They were never going to take us to Om. Didn't you hear that man asking about a room? They were going to take us upstairs. He was unbuttoning your coat.
It was warm in there, said Emmy,
but she didn't sound entirely certain.
I think he was just trying to be helpful.
Helpful?
Kate's voice went up.
They meant to rape us, Emmy!
It felt very strange to say it. There was a moment of silence as the truck bumped along, and then Emmy said,
You mean like the Sabine women?
As if rape were something that happened only in ancient Rome. Kate found it entirely infuriating.
Like all those women with the Bosch babies. How do you think that happened? It certainly wasn't out of pure and lasting affection.
But those were Germans,
said Emmy, as if that made all the difference.
These were Frenchmen. They're our allies.
They're men, said Kate, thinking of Julia and that doctor.
He was meant to be her colleague, and look how he'd behaved.
I'm pretty sure these were deserters. Didn't you see how they looked when you asked after their regiment? They were men with nothing left to lose. And we're women, alone, in a war zone, in the middle of the night.
But
she could see Emmy struggling with it, fighting it, and wanted to shake her.
Everyone's been so helpful.
Yes, to the Smith unit. But tonight we weren't the Smith unit. We were just two women alone. You can't just assume that every man you meet is going to help you.
But Emmy did assume that. In Emmy's world, everyone was there to help. And why wouldn't they? She was Emmy Van Alden. Doors magically opened for her, and courtiers threw down their cloaks in the mud. It was like being Queen of England without the responsibilities. The engine gave a strange hiccup, but Kate barely noticed. She was too busy being upset.
We should never have been there in the first place. But no, you had to up and go to Courcelles by yourself in the middle of a snowstorm.
Emmy curled herself into a pretzel on the bench.
It wasn't snowing when I left.
It wasn't snowing. That was all she had to say? They were in a war zone in the middle of the night. She had no idea where they were or how much essence they had left, and somewhere was a group of French deserters. Kate was reasonably sure they were deserters who wanted them dead. And all Emmy could say was that she hadn't known it would snow.
Do you ever think of anyone but yourself? Kate demanded. I told you we'd have a new truck soon.
She broke off as the engine made a strange sputtering sound and then went alarmingly quiet. Kate managed to turn the wheel, steering the truck to the side of the road before the jitney stalled out entirely. Emmy's voice was full of trepidation.
What happened?
We're out of essence.
There ought to have been another can in the truck, but there wasn't, because she hadn't bothered to check before she went running off after Emmy, convinced Emmy was lying dead in a ditch somewhere between Graycourt and Courcelles.
We could try to walk, but I have no idea where we are. We're going to have to camp here until morning.
Here being the side of a road, which could, in the snow, be just about anywhere. They were surrounded by barbed wire, stunted trees, and the ruined remains of houses, which could have been anywhere between the Somme and Switzerland. With the headlamps of the jitney dead, it was pitch black. the true darkness of the more horrifying sort of fairy tale. And it was cold, bitter, wretched cold. In the darkness, Kate heard Emmy fumbling with her haversack. A hand emerged right in front of Kate's face, and a small voice said,
"Biscuit?"
Kate thought about saying no, on principle, but she was hungry. Without a word, she took the biscuit from Emmy. They crunched in silence for a moment, and then Emmy said,
"I am sorry."
When Kate didn't answer, she went on, stumbling over her words.
"I meant to leave Courcelles by 2 at the latest, but then Madame Le Panas was so ill, and I couldn't leave her."
"So really, it's not your fault at all," said Kate, knowing she was being unfair, but unable to help herself because she was cold and scared and really not at all looking forward to freezing to death. "Nothing is ever your fault. It's always Saint Emmeline off to save the world, and never mind who gets hurt along the way, because you always mean well."
"But I don't know what else I could have done," said Emmy helplessly.
"You could have not been there. We should never have taken Courcelles in the first place, but that was another one of your impulses. You had to have Courcelles, and then poor Margaret had a nervous breakdown." Admittedly, Margaret would probably have had a nervous breakdown anyway, but Kate was in no mood to be reasonable. Being reasonable didn't seem to have gotten her anywhere. She had tried to be reasonable, but Emmy had gone running off on her own, and here they were. "And never mind that we have a schedule designed to keep everything running properly and everyone safe. You have to go running off to the edge of beyond." She could feel Emmy stiffening on the bench next to her.
"There was nothing for me to do at Greycourt."
"There's always something to do. There were parcels to sort and children to teach and letters to write. You could have found something. You could have helped Florence with the animals or Nell with sorting books. You just didn't want to because it's so much more fun playing Lady Bountiful among the peasantry." Kate hadn't meant to say it. She hadn't even known she was thinking it. But there it was. The words hung in the cold air, ugly between them. In a very small voice, Emmy said,
"I was just trying to help."
"I know." Kate could feel the cold seeping into her bones, the cold and the weariness. She should have felt vindicated, but instead, she just felt drained, because Emmy was trying to help.
"You can't just do whatever you want whenever you want to. You've been so sheltered, you have no idea what's out there."
"Like those men tonight?"
There was a moment of silence, and then Emmy asked,
"Do you really think they meant to force themselves on us?"
"Yes." And if they were deserters, possibly also kill them, but Emmy sounded upset enough that Kate decided not to mention that.
"Emmy, I know you didn't know."
"But that's no excuse, is it?"
Emmy sounded frantic.
"You're right. I got us both into this. I made you come here. If you hadn't hit that man—"
"Thank my stepfather for that. He taught me. I never thought I'd use it, though."
Next to her on the bench, Kate could feel Emmy shivering, and not just from cold. Feeling thoroughly chastened, Kate scooted a little closer until they were side to side.
"We'll get out of this, Emmy. We will."
They sat in the dark, huddled together for warmth, listening to the tree branches crackle in the wind.
"Do you know what time it is?"
asked Emmy. They used one of Emmy's precious matches to check the watch pinned to Kate's jacket.
9:30,
said Kate, wanting to cry. She'd thought it was well past midnight. It would only get colder throughout the night. Their hands and feet were already dangerously numb. At least 9 hours to get through before it would be light enough to venture on.
"We could do calisthenics to keep warm," suggested Emmy.
"Or we could sit as still as possible so we don't attract wolves."
"Are there wolves?"
"I don't know," admitted Kate. "But I feel as if there ought to be. What was that?"
"It sounded like hooves."
Emmy clutched Kate's hand, or maybe Kate clutched Emmy's hand. And a voice, in English, called out,
"Hello? Anyone there?" Americans?
Asked Kate in a high-pitched voice she hardly recognized as her own.
Even better, Canadians,
the voice responded, and the clopping noise resolved itself into two sets of horses' hooves. Kate shielded her eyes as an ever-ready flashlight blazed in her face.
Sorry about that, Miss Moran?
And Miss Van Alden.
Now her eyes had recovered, Kate could see them properly, two Canadians with the distinctive badge on their hats showing a beaver and two crossed axes.
You're the foresters.
Guilty as charged. What are you doing all the way out here?
We got lost in the snow and then...
Emmy broke off, looking at Kate uncertainly.
We had a spot of trouble with our truck, said Kate briefly.
It seemed best not to go into the rest of it.
We were visiting one of our villages, got turned around in the snow and stalled out here.
Fortunately, they seemed to think that an entirely sensible story. There was a murmured conversation between the two Canadians.
You'd best come back with us. We've our housekeeper there as chaperone,
added the shorter of the two men hastily, turning a little pink about the ears.
She can give you assurance as to our honorable intentions.
We never doubted them, said Kate gravely. They had no idea.
Thank you. We appreciate your hospitality.
Oh, it's nothing, nothing at all. Happy to share the old chateau. Can you ride Pillion? It's too far to walk. We'll send someone to fetch your car in the morning.
Poor old Jitney,
murmured Emmy, patting the truck's side.
Do you really think you can fix her?
She looks like she's had a time of it, said the shorter Canadian cheerfully.
Kate thought she might have sat next to him at Thanksgiving, but she wasn't entirely sure. She'd been too loopy with fever to pay much attention.
But we'll do our best. At least we can offer you a warm fire and some hot soup.
It would be soup, thought Kate madly. But these weren't French deserters. These were their Canadian friends. They were back through the other side of the looking glass, the one where everyone was a friend. They were the women of the Smith College Relief Unit, due every courtesy, not just women alone, easy prey.
Soup would be lovely, she managed.
Emmy made a choking noise, covering her face with her hands. The Canadians clearly thought that was a perfectly reasonable reaction to being lost in the cold.
You look done in, the taller one said sympathetically. If I can get Bucephalus here close enough, do you think you could use the running board as a mounting block?
Chapter 18.
Merry Christmas to all at home. Your very own Smith unit is exhausted with merrymaking. I never thought I'd be sick of parties, but you try having 10 of them and see how you feel. Think about having two Sunday school parties a day for 5 days, and that's about the shape of it. We started out with our own private party for the unit, then one for the unit's friends, aviators and Quakers and engineers and foresters and doctors and even a few odd Brits. The only one who didn't make it was the partridge in the pear tree. Some of those men came 4 hours to spend 30 minutes eating plum pudding with us, but they said it was worth it. Probably more for the plum pudding than our dubious charms. Most of us haven't had a proper wash in weeks. Florence Luz claims the dirt keeps the warmth in. Then it was back to work with parties for all our villages. Just imagine the mercury well below zero and all the roads clogged with snow and us in our little trucks, with Ethel Ledbetter dressed up as Père Noël in a red bathrobe. Then back to Greycourt to pack more presents and do it all again, and again the next day. We're all terribly grateful that Christmas comes only once a year, even in the Somme, where terrible things happen all the time. It was so cold in those military barracks we're using as village halls that one little girl froze her toes and had to stick her feet through a hole in the wall to be washed with snow. We had to organize a running around game to keep everyone from frostbite, which got rather more exciting than planned when two stray dogs decided to join in the fun and bit Ethel, who promptly fainted and had to be revived with, you guessed it, more snow. Don't you see the fun you're missing? But it was really touching to see how happy they all were.
the old people as much as the children. Miss Eleanor Nell Baldwin, class of 1914, to her family. December 1917, Graycourt, France. The Canadians were true to their word and perfectly lovely in every way. Their housekeeper, in a flannel wrapper and long gray braid, came out to make hot soup and sent Emmy and Kate off to bed in her own room with blankets that smelled of lavender and a hot water bottle tucked in by their feet. But Emmy kept thinking back to that other room, the man with his arm around her shoulders, unbuttoning her coat for her. "Don't say anything to anyone about this, will you?" Kate murmured as they snuggled down into their borrowed bed, their borrowed chaperone on guard in the next room. "About those men, I mean. If anyone asks, say just what we told the foresters. We got lost in the snow, and the jitney broke down on us."
"But why? If they're deserters, shouldn't someone be told? Unless you don't want them to get into trouble."
"I don't want us to get into trouble."
The bed dipped as Kate rolled onto her side.
"We can't let anyone see us as a liability. If they think we're weak, that we need defending, our position here might be compromised."
"You didn't need defending. You defended both of us."
Emmy hated how useless she had been, how entirely ignorant.
"I got lucky. Another time?"
Kate lowered her voice.
"It's not common knowledge yet, but there's a rumor our sector might be transferred over to the Brits. If it is, they don't like women in their war zone. They'll seize on any excuse to see us out."
"But they've been so helpful."
"You mean Captain DeWitt has been so helpful?"
said Kate with some amusement. "We don't need the authorities being reminded that we're female. Right now, they're charmed by the idea of us, and they like what we're doing, and everyone is only too happy to help. But that's only so long as we pull our own weight and don't cause anyone any trouble. No one wants to have to shoot a soldier over us, or deal with the flurry in the American press if American women are, well, hurt."
"If you and I had been hurt tonight, what would have happened?"
Kate thought for a moment. Emmy could hear the old building creaking around them.
"They would want to keep it quiet, I imagine. It would be very embarrassing to both governments. And that would be it for the unit. They wouldn't want us here after that, or anyone like us."
Emmy had never thought that she might be endangering not only herself, but the future of the unit.
"But nothing happened," said Kate firmly. "We're both fine, and the Canadians are pleased as punch with having rescued us. It will make a good story, we'll both be teased for getting lost, and no one ever needs to know the rest of it."
But Emmy knew. Yes, they were in danger here, she'd always known that, but it had been an impersonal sort of danger, the same sort of dangers that threatened the foresters or their Quaker friends over at Om. Shells, Germans, frostbite, the usual dangers of war and weather. Emmy felt terribly naive. Sheltered, Kate had called her. She'd never thought of herself as sheltered. She'd thought her settlement house work had made her terribly worldly, but she had always known herself to be safe. These sorts of things happened, but they happened to other people. They happened to factory workers and French villagers, not girls like them, not Smith women, not to a Van Alden. For the first time, Emmy noticed the safeguards built into Kate's schedules. She'd assumed, if she'd thought about it, that they went places in pairs because they needed to maximize their few forms of transportation, or because it made sense for a doctor to visit alongside a social worker, or for a social worker or doctor to ride along with the store. But what it really meant was that no one was ever out on her own. Because it was a war zone, and there were desperate men about. It was hard to remember that when everything went on as usual, when there were engineers and aviators for tea on a Sunday, French poilus, such nice, friendly poilus, helping to put up temporary houses, and Canadian foresters visiting with loads of firewood and greenery, decking the orangery with wreaths and garlands as their own particular Christmas gift to the unit. Everyone was so kind. But out there, beyond the gates of Graycourt, were places where a woman wasn't safe, and not just because there was a war on. The idea that anyone would hurt them, Emmy just couldn't quite wrap her mind around it. To be sure, there had been a French soldier who had made an inappropriate comment to Alice in Paris, but he had apologized profusely once she had identified herself as American, and they had all thought it was a great joke. Except it wasn't a great joke to the French women, was it? Or to women who weren't them. The one positive bit was that Kate didn't seem to be angry with her anymore. Emmy told herself that was a good thing, at least. They were friends again. Mostly. Without saying anything about it, Kate quietly changed the schedules, assigning Emmy to the villagers in the basse-cour on the pretense that Alice was too busy with the trucks to do social service work as well. Emmy appreciated it, she did, but it was hard knowing that it was charity of sorts, giving her something to do where she could be close at hand. Playing Lady Bountiful, Kate had called it. It wasn't, Emmy realized, terribly much fun being on the other end of it, knowing that your life was being managed for you, for your own good, but even so, because you couldn't be trusted to do it yourself. She would do better from now on, Emmy promised herself, and redoubled her efforts on the Christmas planning. Caroling on Christmas Eve, the unit's own Christmas party on Christmas morning, a party for all their officer friends Christmas Day, parties for all the villages at the rate of 2 a day thereafter, with a personally chosen present for every single adult and child in their domain. The plans grew more and more elaborate, a fishing game for the children, with gifts attached to hooks behind a screen, matching gifts to ages, praying the packages from America would arrive and going on an emergency buying trip when they didn't, hours in the frozen cellar sorting and packaging and attaching fiddly little hooks to fishing line. It was a blow when all plans were canceled Christmas Eve. It was a beautiful moonlit night, like an illustration out of a book of carols, snow like frosting on the old stone church, and the authorities, speeding through in their cars, warning everyone that there would be air raids, that mass was canceled.
But we knew our French carols so well, Emmy mourned. Even the descants.
We'll still have our parties. Those are during the daytime, Kate consoled her, but it seemed like a very inauspicious start. When Kate planned things, they stayed planned.
Maybe you should have had someone else in charge of Christmas, said Emmy glumly.
You can't control the weather, or the German planes, Kate said sleepily, but Emmy wasn't mollified. It helped to wake up on Christmas morning and see the sun shining on the snow and the delight of the other girls when they stumbled into breakfast to be greeted by Captain Linoleum, a 6-foot-tall roll of linoleum with a face chalked by Nell, a khaki cap, stick arms holding a Smith Unit comfort bag with a generous check from the class of 1904, and a ribbon-decked wastebasket at his feet. Kate's, borrowed and bedecked, holding a pile of presents.
Captain Linoleum offers his Christmas greetings to the unit and will soon unroll himself on the barrack floor to warm our feet, said Emmy breathlessly, distributing such luxuries as hot water bottles, briquettes, and all-weather socks amid cries of delight, while Marie's contribution, coffee, real coffee with real cream from their own cows, steamed on the table in their red and white cups that looked more like bowls.
New phonograph records! Thank goodness! I thought if I had to hear Alice playing Caruso's O Sole Mio one more time, I was going to scream. Oh, look, this one's a foxtrot. We can dance it with the boys tonight.
In our hobnailed boots.
Better than our rubber rain boots.
I knew I forgot to pack my dancing slippers.
Socks! Socks without holes! I may avoid frostbite yet.
And cream for chilblains,
Emmy said happily. They all had chilblains, and nasty things they were.
That nice doctor in the hospital in Nell told me what to get. He says it's a sovereign remedy.
Dr. Stapleton, said Kate, glancing at Julia.
Make sure it doesn't have arsenic in it, commented Julia shortly.
Didn't people used to use arsenic for their complexions? Asked Alice. Or was that belladonna?
Hand it here, said Dr. Stringfellow, and sniffed. Well, it won't kill you, at least.
I don't care if it kills me, said Nell fervently. I'm putting it on now.
There were parcels from home as well, parcels and mail. Emmy's mother had sent a letter, and Emmy's heart lifted as she opened it, only to plunge again when she saw it was only a series of clippings, press related to the passing of the Suffrage Act in New York last month, her mother holding a banner. "The good work continues, first the state, then the country," her mother had scrawled along the top. Underneath was a bank draft with the scribbled injunction, "For your village schools." She hadn't expected anything, not really. Emmy had arranged for presents for the boys before she left in August, knowing her parents would never remember. A new phonograph for Jack, a camera for Nat, a glass case for George to house his rock collection, a phenakistoscope for Bobby. They would have been put under the tree by the housekeeper. Kate had cut the strings on a brown paper parcel. "It's a present from my parents and brothers. New boots. My mother says..." Her voice caught. "My mother says the saleswoman at Gimble's told her these are the very best for keeping the damp out. She must have bought these and had them sent right after we left."
"My mother sends Christmas greetings and wishes us all well," Emmy lied.
It wasn't entirely a lie. She was sure her mother did wish them all well, when she remembered. Her mother had always liked Kate.
"What are those?"
In the middle of the table was a pile of paper scrolls tied up in ribbon.
"A surprise for you," said Dr. Stringfellow complacently. "Santa made it through last night and left a note for each of you."
"Santa's handwriting looks strangely familiar," said Julia.
"I have no idea what you're talking about. You're meant to read them aloud and guess who they're for,"
Dr. Stringfellow added helpfully. "Go on now, children."
"I think I found Emmy's," said Anne, unrolling the first scroll. "Our angel of the barrack, she tramps both near and far, through snow and mud and dark of night, not waiting for a car. Although she may not be able to tell a rooster from a hen, when it comes to building chicken coops, her strength is the strength of 10.
Emmy winced.
"No one will ever let me forget those roosters, will they?"
"They made very tasty soup," said Alice, trying to make her feel better. Liza put the next scroll right up to her nose, squinting at it.
"This one's cheating. There's a name in it. Though small of stature she may be, her heart is undismayed by broken trucks and missing coal and shipments all delayed. Our patient Kate, our canny Kate. Couldn't we be trusted to guess?"
Dr. Stringfellow shrugged.
"Literary license.
She keeps us all on time, she bosses and she wheedles, and finds in every haystack a regular crop of needles. Our stalwart assistant director, she keeps us all on time, and so it fits her schedule. I'll promptly end this rhyme."
"Can you really call that a rhyme?" asked Maud, shuddering delicately.
"A rhyme, certainly," said Ethel Ledbetter. "But is a rhyme necessarily a poem? The troubadours of old..."
"I'm a doctor, not a poet," retorted Dr. Stringfellow, cutting Ethel off before she could get started on chansons de something or other.
"You try making 14 doggerel verses all by yourself."
Nell's poem was about her library. Anne Dawlish had an elaborate conceit about their savior being a carpenter. Alice worked wonders with their cars. Liza blushed at, "She always wants to lend a hand, despite a broken arm. Canadian, ami, engineer, alike have felt her charms." And while Maud tossed her head at, "No peddler sells better than she who runs our store. She sells them soap and sabot and aprons by the score," Emmy could tell she was pleased.
"Have we had any outbreaks of lice since I sold everyone soap? I thought not," Maud said haughtily. "And there were washtubs too, I'll have you know."
"I think all the lice just died of cold," said Alice, shivering. "If you wore more wool and less lace," began Gwen Mills in her patronizing way.
"Then how would we keep up the elegant reputation of the unit?" drawled Julia, who was perfectly happy to defend Alice if it meant squashing Gwen. Emmy watched them all bickering and thought how very odd it was that 6 months ago, most of them hadn't known each other at all, and here they were with a very clear idea of each other's strengths and foibles. They might mock Alice's lace collars, but they all knew that Alice could fix any truck that had a bit of life left in it. And Gwen Mills might be an utter pill, but if you were sick in the middle of the night, she'd be there with a wash basin, holding back your hair. Even Maud. She complained, but she was out there in that truck in all weathers, pedaling with all her might. They might not all love each other, but by a strange alchemy, they all worked together. Even if Emmy wished that someone would remember her for something other than chickens.
"These are lovely," Emmy said, to make up for feeling ungrateful. "How did you ever do it all?" "Don't you mean Santa?"
"I do pay attention, you know," said Dr. Stringfellow, looking pleased.
"I'm not one for speeches, but what you're doing here, what we're all doing here, is something worth doing, and I think you all, every single one, should be proud of yourselves. Those poems may not be much in terms of meter, but they're a tribute to each and every one of you and all you do."
"There you go, rhyming again,"
pointed out Florence Luz cheerfully.
"Thank you," said Dr. Stringfellow. "I'll try to keep this bit in prose, shall I? I wanted to do something for all of you before I go. I'll be leaving in January. It's been an honor, and I'll dine out on tales of the unit for the next decade, but my own work and family are waiting for me in Philadelphia."
"She has a family?" whispered Alice on Kate's other side.
"I heard that, Miss Patton, and yes, I do. You'll be getting a new director and a new doctor, but not until January. You're stuck with me until then, and I warn you, I mean to eat my share of the Christmas chocolates."
"Must you go?"
asked Emmy. Dr. Stringfellow was brusque, impatient, and frankly uninterested in administration, but there was something terribly reassuring about her.
"Bless you, child. I never wanted or asked to be director. And I only hope you're better served by the next one. I only agreed to be assistant director because Betsy promised me I'd never actually have to do anything about it."
For a moment, the ghost of Mrs. Rutherford was there with them. If a living person could be a ghost, thought Emmy. It seemed wrong that they should be celebrating all this here without her, when all of it was, one way or another, her doing, from the design of the uniform to the purchase of the chickens. Dr. Stringfellow cleared her throat.
"Let's give thanks where thanks is due. To our assistant director, who did all the real directing so I could go on doing the job I actually know how to do. Kate, the first chocolate is for you."
There was hugging and exclaiming and ironic comments from Maud and general pandemonium, and Emmy watched her friend surrounded by the unit, her thin face glowing, and thought how long ago August felt, and how wonderful it was how Kate had come into her own, and how she wished, just once, she could be more like Kate, confident like Kate, strong like Kate, organized like Kate.
"It's no more than anyone would do," said Kate, once the last strains of "For She's a Jolly Good Fellow" had died down.
"Oh, it is," said Dr. Stringfellow frankly. "And I hope our new director realizes how lucky she is to have you."
"Who will the new director be?"
asked Alice, putting into words what they were all wondering.
"You all know her already, Mrs. Barrett of the Paris Committee. And the new doctor, not that you asked, will be Dr. Clare of the class of 92. Here."
Dr. Stringfellow rooted around under her chair and produced a large box of chocolates.
"Mrs. Barrett sent this as an earnest of her good intentions, and it's an earnest of my good intentions that I didn't eat it all myself and hide the note."
"Shouldn't we save it for the children?"
suggested Emmy, and was promptly booed down.
"Hush, angel of the barrack," said Nell.
"Christmas won't be Christmas without scarfing down all the chocolates and feeling sick after."
"If you do," said Dr. Stringfellow, "don't come to me. I'm strictly off duty today and mean to be as much of a glutton as the rest of you. All dyspeptics report to Dr. Prine.
Now, let's make sure we're ready to receive our guests, shall we? Everyone to their stations. And that's as much directing as I intend to do.
Did you know?
Emmy asked Kate as they heaved their stove out of their barrack to carry to the orangery. The orangery was to be their ballroom for the day, and with all the stoves burning at once, plus a rusty old iron range Emmy had found in the cellars, on which they were going to cook creamed potatoes for their 75 guests, they thought they could just about keep it above freezing.
About Dr. Stringfellow leaving?
Yes. Kate adjusted her grip on the stove, head down, but not about the new director. Emmy backed down the path, bent nearly double to stay level with Kate.
She seems very capable.
I know. Alice says she serves a good dinner. They staggered through one of the doors of the orangery, setting down the stove. Kate straightened, flexing her gloved hands. Maud's been wanting her here for a long time. Emmy glanced over her shoulder.
That doesn't mean, well, what it might mean. We're here now, and there are so many projects in hand, they're not likely to move the unit back to Paris now or put us into canteen work.
I hope not. With the Brits coming, we'll see what happens.
You did do a lovely job with the Christmas parties, Emmy.
Captain Linoleum was an inspiration.
That was really Nell's idea.
Emmy didn't mention that Nell had wanted to call him Captain Duckwalk and provide him with a British flag.
I just found the linoleum roll.
And presents for everyone. Someone was calling Kate. She paused a moment to add, I know you've worked so hard on this. Thank you. That was very much the assistant director speaking, not her old friend Kate. It felt like a consolation prize. She might have messed up everything else, but at least she planned a good party. Emmy pushed the thought away. It was a good party. It was an excellent party, really. The old orangery had been made beautiful by the foresters, who had decked it with all the greenery they could find, nestling candles amid sprigs of holly, stringing boughs and garlands everywhere. The meal was a simple one: cold ham and turkey, hot creamed potatoes in massive piles, bread and real butter, and even plum pudding with brandy butter. They'd learned their lesson after the debacle of the tooth mugs. No soups, no multiple courses, nothing fancy, just a good, hearty buffet. Alice brought her Victrola out and cranked it up. Not, Emmy noticed, Caruso this time, but popular songs, songs that people sang along to. People raised their voices to talk over the music, adding to the holiday air. Kate and Julia were in the center of a group of aviators, one of whom was a distant cousin of sorts. Emmy vaguely remembered Julia terrifying him when they were children. The engineers, who had seen some rough action at Cambrai the month before, were being made much of by Liza and Alice. Anne was discussing woodworking with a Canadian forester, and Ethel was expounding on medieval heresies to the Quakers. Dr. Stringfellow was in the midst of a loud but largely amicable debate with a doctor from the hospital at Amiens. For some reason, Kate had requested they not invite the hospital staff from Nell, and Emmy had been mystified but complied, and Alfalfa Bill, one of the Red Cross drivers, had just produced a mandolin when one of the canvas flaps they were using for doors opened, and in walked the Brits.
The Redcoats are coming,
called Red Cross Dave, and promptly fell backward off his chair. They weren't red, they were khaki. There was a senior-looking sort of man, with a great many medals and an extremely ferocious mustache, and a younger man with very carefully arranged hair. And then there was Captain DeWitt, who was promptly pigeonholed by Maud.
You didn't tell us you were a lord. My friend says—
The Victrola hiccuped. Captain DeWitt looked at Emmy over Maud's head, telegraphing extreme distress. Suddenly, the lights seemed much brighter, the room warmer, the music louder. Everything resumed at double the speed.
If you'll excuse me, Emmy said to the Canadian she'd been speaking to. Nell, is it time to send out the goat?
With a nod, Nell whisked outside and reappeared with Zaylee, who looked like an illustration from a children's book in tiered skirts and ruffled pantalettes, her goat following along behind her on a beribboned leash.
They decked Zaylee's pet goat, Minerva, with white panniers with big red bows, filled with Ramsay's cigarettes, a surprise treat for their guests. There was a mad dash for the goat, everyone exclaiming over the cigarettes, and Emmy seized the opportunity to rescue Captain DeWitt from Maud.
Cigarette? I'm afraid these are ill come by. We had a parcel misdelivered to us and couldn't figure out who they were meant to be for, so we decided we'd just distribute them broadly and make up for it that way.
Robin Hood with tobacco, suggested Captain DeWitt, raising a brow. He seemed particularly tall and thin and British in his dress uniform, looking as though he'd stepped out of a bandbox rather than comfortably splattered with mud and herding cows.
I can't say whom we robbed, since we don't know, admitted Emmy. But enough of our parcels have gone missing that we felt it was really more of a trade than anything else. I had no idea you were a peer of the realm.
I'm not. My father is, and he hardly counts.
Captain DeWitt cast a wary glance behind him.
It's a bit stifling. Do you mind if we step out for a moment?
It was all of 50 degrees inside, but something about the press of bodies made it seem warmer than it was. Maud was fighting with Alice over the choice of music for the phonograph, and the goat was trying to eat someone's uniform.
Yes, let's, said Emmy, and quelled the thought that Kate probably wouldn't approve.
Kate was deep in conversation with Captain DeWitt's commanding officer, the one with the bushy mustache.
I can't promise the air will be much clearer out here, but at least it will be quieter.
She led Captain DeWitt out of the orangery to a makeshift bench overlooking the green water of the moat with its well-worn placard reading, Bon à boire. They sat down on the bench, the air crisp on Emmy's flushed cheeks, the bare trees rustling around them. She'd sat out dances before, in ballrooms in New York, decked in satin and gauze, pearls at her neck and ears, hothouse flowers blooming. She'd sat with any number of eligible bachelors, Yale men and Harvard men, old money and somewhat less old money. She'd sat on narrow gold benches in dresses that bared her neck and shoulders, her legs clad in whisper-thin silk stockings and heeled slippers instead of heavy lisle and hobnail boots. And yet, she'd never felt so bare, so aware of the wind finding the naked spaces between her collar and her chignon, the backs of her ears, the nape of her neck. She could feel the plank bend as Captain DeWitt sat next to her, painfully aware of every movement, every creak of the wood as the plank dipped, tilting them closer. She could smell soap and wool. This must be his best uniform, the one that got saved, that didn't get drenched in trench mud. Emmy remembered, uncomfortably, that her own uniform had been rather spottily laundered and was badly patched in several places, and that those brave touches of French blue were now a rather dirty gray.
How is one partly a peer? Emmy asked, just to have something to say. I thought you either were or weren't.
That depends on who you ask, said Captain DeWitt.
He turned slightly toward her, his eyes green and brown like the moat.
My father is what they call a soap and pickle peer, still with the stink of the shop about him.
What's wrong with soap and pickles?
Captain DeWitt looked at her quizzically, as if trying to figure out if she really meant it.
They're common. Trade. When I was at Harrow, it was considered a great joke to try to brand me with a burning biscuit.
Emmy sat up straight, making the bench bounce.
That's ridiculous. Think of the joy you've brought to people with your biscuits. What have any of them ever done for anyone?
Captain DeWitt smiled wryly.
Bunk with William the Conqueror? Affright the French at Agincourt?
You're allies with the French now, so that's not much use, is it? Affrighting the French, I mean. I'd far rather have tea biscuits.
Struck by a sudden thought, she tilted her head up at him, studying his face.
Is that why you were masquerading as the Scarlet Pimpernel? I thought you wouldn't tell me your name because it was something awful, like Algernon.
Well, there's that too. And no, he added, with the hint of a smile, like sunlight on the moat. It's not Algernon.
It can't be more awful than mine. Imagine going through your life named Emmeline.
I tried to get my governess to call me Lily, but my mother found out and put a stop to it.
Why Lily?
He rested the flat of his hand against the seat of the bench, his arm brushing the back of Emmy's jacket. Well, you know, flowers and all that. Emmy hunched her shoulders, looking away, feeling all the old awkwardness descend on her. She had thought it sounded delicate and feminine, the name of someone who floated rather than clomped and didn't wear dancing slippers the size of boats. But she didn't want to admit to any of that.
The lilies of the field that toil not, offered Captain DeWitt.
Oh, do we toil, said Emmy with feeling, trying to make a joke of it. I've spent the week in the freezing cellar stringing gifts on bits of fishing line for the children.
Why fishing line?
Because we didn't have yarn to waste. We wanted to make it all more special for them, not just handing each child a gift, but making, well, a bit of a production of it. We've made a sort of screen and labeled the gifts according to age, and each one will get a go with the fishing rod.
Captain DeWitt was listening to her ramble on, listening as if every word meant something,
and Emmy realized how silly it must all sound. The ruins of the outbuilding reproached her, falling ceilings and missing walls. There were men dying only a few miles away, and here she was, going on about toys and fishing line. She looked hopelessly at him.
It all sounds very trivial, doesn't it, in the midst of all this? But we just wanted to give them, oh, I don't know, something to make up for all those years without. Something wonderful.
I think it sounds wonderful.
He was looking at her in a way that made her feel like she'd just come out of the gloom into strong sunlight.
I think you're wonderful.
No, I'm not. Oh, goodness, you have no idea. I wish...
Emmy had to clamp her lips shut to keep it from all pouring out. Margaret and Corcel and the snowstorm, all the mistakes she'd made, all the dangers she'd brought on them. Very gently, Captain DeWitt asked,
Is something the matter?
Any excuse, Kate had said. The British would take any excuse to evict them from the war zone. Emmy blurted out,
Is it true that you're taking over our zone from the French?
Captain DeWitt sat back. She could feel him move away from her, sitting very still and straight.
Where did you hear that?
Here and there,
said Emmy vaguely, wishing she hadn't said anything, that they could go back to talking about fishing line and how wonderful she was. Captain DeWitt leaned his head back, staring up at the hard silver sky.
So much for secrecy. I'm sure the Kaiser has it down on his calendar already.
Does that mean yes?
Possibly.
That meant yes. Emmy stared down, folding and refolding her hands in her lap. She couldn't seem to figure out what to do with her thumbs, of which she suddenly had 10.
They say you don't believe in women in the war zone. The lot of you, I mean, not you personally.
Captain DeWitt waited a moment before speaking. She could feel him weighing his response.
As a rule, yes. If we have to rally around and protect you, we lose valuable time and resources.
Which was just what Kate had been saying. Emmy looked at him with alarm.
But we don't need you to rally around and protect us. We're not those sort of women. Really, we're not.
Captain DeWitt raised a brow.
What sort of women are you?
Smith women.
Said Emmy firmly. When that didn't seem to make the desired impression, she translated for him.
We're rather like Oxford women, I suppose, only without the accents.
Oxford has women's colleges, yes,
Captain DeWitt said slowly.
My sister is in her final year at Somerville, but the university doesn't award degrees to them.
Emmy was horrified.
That's barbaric. It's positively medieval.
That surprised Captain DeWitt into a laugh, a rich chuckle that cleared the shadows from his eyes and made him look years younger.
Says the colonial,
We haven't thrown tea in the harbor for ages, but I have my degree and I have the right to vote. In New York, at least,
Emmy amended.
It's all very well, said Captain DeWitt,
laugh lines fanning out around his eyes as he looked down at her.
But not precisely applicable here. You can't vote away an invading German army.
Emmy perked up, struck by the idea.
Wouldn't it be nice if one could? If we could just vote them away? If all the women of the world could vote, we'd have far fewer wars.
I'm not sure Madame Defarge would agree with that, said Captain DeWitt dryly. Or Milady de Winter. I can't tell you anything about what will happen here when the shift occurs, mostly because I don't know.
She noticed that he said when, not if.
Do you think we'll be allowed to stay?
You know I can't comment on that.
Emmy looked up at him, her eyes meeting his.
That won't stop me asking.
Do you mean to wear me down?
He asked. And somehow, he was holding both her hands in his.
Could I?
Asked Emmy, with great interest.
Yes,
he said. And Emmy noticed that his eyes had little golden flecks in them, and that the braid on his uniform was scratchy beneath her palms.
I rather think you could.